I don't want to belabor this. It's a very unpleasant story, and we did mention a thing or two about it last night. Gibeah is in the tribe of Benjamin, and this is one of the darkest stories, of course, in the history of of God's people, Israel. Briefly, again, a Levite from Ephraim had a concubine from Judah. She ran away home, and he went to get her. That means from Benjamin, he would, from Ephraim, he would cross through Benjamin into Judah, where Bethlehem would be to take her back. Her father delayed things, and so when they finally got away, it was much too late. Getting dark as they passed what would be Jerusalem at a later time, by the time they got to Gibeah, it looks like it was about dark. The only person who would allow them in to practice biblical hospitality, to give someone a place to stay for the night and some food refresh them, the only one who would do that was a man from Ephraim. He wasn't really even a resident of Benjamin. And soon, worthless fellows surrounded the house demanding that the old man from Ephraim send the Levite out, that we may know him. You understand what that means. Every aspect of this story, of course, is unpleasant. Eventually, the Levite sends his concubine out, and essentially you have a gang rape. They abuse her all night, and toward day, then she tries to get back in, falls, dies with her hands on the threshold. When the Levite gets back home, he divides her body into 12 pieces and sends them among the 12 tribes of Israel. Every part of the story gruesome to the highest degree. The people respond. The whole country apparently is outraged, although we would understand this is a very wicked time anyway, but this was too much for them. And so they say such a thing has never happened or been seen from the day that the people of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it. Take counsel and speak. And you're told then in the story from Dan to Beersheba, from the far north to the far south, the whole country went to war with Benjamin. Gibeah, again, is a town in Benjamin. One of the things I don't think I got to last time was that while Benjamin will be almost exterminated in this civil war, actually the whole nation was punished by it, because I may forget how many battles, but at least two battles in the beginning, Benjamin wins, and wins by far. So the whole country is affected. Many people die, but especially Benjamin. Eventually, they have 600 men left, and then the rest of the country begins to wonder, how will the tribe continue? They don't have wives, 600 men left. Well, they realize that Jabesh in Gilead was a town that didn't respond at all. They didn't come help to punish Benjamin. So they took 400 women from Jabesh Gilead, but that still leaves 200 Benjamites who are without wives. All of this is strange. One of the factors that makes it difficult is before they began the battle, they took oaths. We'll not do this or that. We'll not give wives to women to Benjamin to take as wives. So the instructions are go and lie in to the 200 Benjamite men. Go and lie in ambush in the vineyards and watch. If the daughters of Shiloh come out, this is at festival time, if the daughters of Shiloh come out of the vineyards to dance in the dances, then come out of the vineyards and snatch each man his wife from the daughters of Shiloh and go to the land of Benjamin. I'm glad that Benjamin was spared. I'm sure you are too. The Apostle Paul comes from the tribe of Benjamin. But again, you're reminded, and this is the last thought of these three chapters, if I go back to Judges and read the story. The reason was everyone did what was right in his own eyes. There are four comparisons beginning at this point to describe unfaithful Israel. They may seem a little strange to us, but I think we can get a little bit of meaning out of them. Grapes in the wilderness, a luxuriant vine, first part of chapter 10, a trained calf, a toddler or a young child. All of these, though, if I look closely, will stress God's past care for Israel. And in response, Israel's reckless ingratitude, and then the last part of it would be the consequences of their ingratitude. Like grapes, verse 10, like grapes in the wilderness I found Israel. Like the first fruit on the fig tree in its first season, I saw your fathers. But they came to Baal Peor and consecrated themselves to the thing of shame and became detestable, detestable like the thing they love. Hosea, for the moment, looks back to an earlier time, image-wise, to Israel's youth when God found her, so to speak, like grapes in the wilderness. I don't know whether you can identify with this or not. I remember as a boy with my cousins or with other friends, we had nothing to do at the time, so we were traipsing through the woods to see what we could see. I remember more than once wild grapes growing. And I don't know, most people might not want to partake of wild grapes, but they look pretty good in that setting. This seems to be the image that is used here. Like grapes in the wilderness, or on the other hand, the first fruit of a fig tree in its first year to bear fruit. These picture, I think, are intended to picture for us a rare and delightful find, to say the least. I find a good thing in a place where I don't expect to find it. But even in her youth in the wilderness, before the promised land, they're on the way, she fell into Baal worship, and this is in Numbers chapter 25. They joined the Moabites at Baal Peor. This reminds us that we have a continuing history of Israel being sucked into Baal worship. This a time, of course, before they even get to the promised land. This is a serious thing if you remember the story, and this is a gory story as well. There's a plague upon the people because of the sins that they are committing, and it's ended when a man takes a spear and or a sword, forget which and actually plunges it through a couple in the very act. So again, this is a wicked time in every way that we can look at it. But in terms of human loss, 24,000 Israelites die as a result of their sin at Baal Peor. So idolatry and whoredom goes well back in Israel's history. I don't know whether we noted this before, but earlier in the chapter, looking at it one way at least, Hosea lists the features of captivity, the features of banishment to Assyria. Obviously, if I'm taken away from my own place, then I'm not going to be happy. It's exile, and in terms of Assyria, probably the most cruel kind of exile. The loss of spiritual discernment, and that's where Gibeah came in. And then the declining birth rate, beginning in verse 10. Verse 11 says, Ephraim's glory shall fly away like a bird, no birth, no pregnancy, no conception. So this will be one of the punishments for their sins. I don't want to be political in this, but it's an example from this week. Elon Musk was, he may have been interviewed several times, and I won't tell you what to think about Elon Musk. But one of the questions, in fact, this is the only part of the interview that I paid attention to. He was asked, what keeps you awake at night, or what makes you afraid? And he took quite a while. He looked around and looked uncomfortable and finally answered. I was a little surprised by his answer. It wasn't a political answer. It wasn't a monetary answer, which I might have expected. What he said was the decline of the birth rate, not just in our nation, but across the world. And so basically what he was saying was, I'm afraid for humanity. Well, that surprised me. He thought about it for a while. It may be he had some other things in mind and really didn't want to say those, but still what he eventually suggested was a surprise to me. This will be one of the punishments, God says through Hosea. Verse 12, even if they bring up children, I will bereave them till none is left. Woe to them when I depart from them. Ephraim, as I have seen, was like a young palm planted in a meadow. This is obviously a difficult verse because translators give you an alternate reading, so they're not sure exactly what it is. A young palm planted in a meadow, and the language, ancient language, can be difficult, and that's why you get two different readings like this. Some think that it actually says like Tyre. Well, still a little bit difficult for me, but one of the ways to look at that, I think of Tyre. Okay, it's on the coast. The Mediterranean in front of it, the mountains to the east back of it. One would think it would have been secure. It was certainly a beautiful place. So one possible meaning is God selected soil like Tyre in which to plant Ephraim, where Ephraim could have become prosperous and beautiful and protected and a secluded spot. I suspect in general that is the meaning here. You would have expected the best for Ephraim, but that's not the way that it worked out. Instead, Notice the contrast. Ephraim will bring his children out to be slaughtered by a foreign power. Verse 14, give them, O Lord, what will you give? Give them a miscarrying womb and dry breasts. So this punishment is being driven home. Every evil of theirs is in Gilgal. There I began to hate them. Because of the wickedness of their deeds, I will drive them out of my house. I will love them no more. All their princes are rebels. Gilgal has been mentioned before. Obviously, in general, a reference to it here is it's a center of idol worship. I know it's not Dan and it's not Bethel, but obviously it is still a place where I can find Baal worship and other things going on. This is where Israel had crossed the Jordan and encamped at Gilgal. This is where they set up the 12 stones. You may remember this. This is a monument. The stones come from the bottom of the River Jordan, but they're stacked up on dry land, and that's a monument, a crude monument, but I suspect an effective monument. I can imagine how many little boys ask their father through the years, Daddy, how did those get there? I know what I would have expressed it to my dad. I would have said, Daddy, did someone put those rocks there on purpose? For some reason, that was always the way I wanted to know, was it done intentionally or not? But that would have been my question. If you read the story, I think actually that is basically given as a reason for doing it. So your children in later times will ask, and then you'll have the opportunity to explain to them the history that they need to know. There also, a new generation was circumcised. That hadn't been done in the wilderness. And that's also where they camped as they marched around the city of Jericho. Ephraim is stricken. Their root is dried up. They shall bear no fruit. This is verse 16. Even though they give birth, I will put their beloved children to death. So we're still not finished with that punishment of no children. This may be taking us aside a little bit too much, but I think of this when I come there. You have probably noticed that as we've moved through Hosea keeps calling the kingdom of Israel, the northern kingdom, most of the time he calls it Ephraim. That's one tribe, Ephraim. Why does everyone get named Ephraim? Well, then I remembered there is a reason you can point to, and so let's take time to go back to Genesis. By the way, the name means something like double fruit, double fruitness, fruitfulness. So it would suggest fertility, abundance, strength. But that's the opposite of what he's been suggesting, of course. And they're just the opposite of the supposed blessings that I would have by worshiping Baal. Okay, back to Genesis 41:52. Joseph had two sons, we're told. Manasseh is oldest, Ephraim the younger. And in the verse, Joseph names Ephraim and gives the reason for it. For God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. In Egypt, taken there, of course, but he names Ephraim because God has blessed me even in this land. And then jumping ahead to chapter 48, when Israel, and of course Israel is Jacob in this context, saw Joseph's sons, he said, who are these? And Joseph said to his fathers, they are my sons who God has given me here. Jacob, of course, has finally been taken to Egypt. And he said, bring them to me, please, that I may bless them. Now the eyes of Israel, Jacob, were dim with age, so that he could not see. So Joseph brought them near him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, I never expected to see your face. And behold, God has let me see your offspring also. Then Joseph removed them from his knees, and he bowed himself with his face to the earth. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near him. And Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on the head of Ephraim, who was the younger, and his left hand on the hand of Manasseh, crossing his hands, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, and there are two or three verses of the blessing, but when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the hand of Ephraim, on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, and he took his father's hand to move it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, not this way, my father, since this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head. But his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. Nevertheless, his younger brother shall be the greater than he, and his offspring shall become a multitude of nations. So he blessed them that day, saying, by you Israel will pronounce blessings, saying, God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh. I take that to mean that if you wanted to bless someone else, you could compare, I would like for you to be blessed like Ephraim and Manasseh. I don't know all the ways this plays out, and I can't remember specific examples now, but Ephraim is an influential tribe. So that's one of the ways that the blessing of Jacob applies to them. Sometimes they are like a kid, maybe a teenager who thinks they are owed everything. I don't always like Ephraim when I read their story. But again, that's another way in which they are a prominent people. Manasseh is too, in a little different way. If you bring up a map of the 12 tribes, you'll see that Manasseh is in two places. Part of them, half of them on the west of the Jordan, half of them on the east. But again, thinking about this, I think there is a particular play on Ephraim in this particular place. The negative side again in verse 17, my God will reject them because they have not listened to him. They shall be wanderers among the nations. I don't know what this means entirely, but a little later before we finish, I'm going to bring a kind of a history lesson so we can understand what really happened in the exile. Okay, we don't know a lot of details in a lot of cases, but I think it probably is the case, and it may fit here with wanderers among the nations, is that all of them don't go to Assyria. Some of them apparently make their way to Egypt. those who go to Assyria, most of them do not return, unlike the exile of Judah later. But they will be wanderers in different places, I think, among the nations. And that may say something about the meaning here. And God has warned them of this before, Leviticus 26. But if in spite of this you will not listen to me, but walk contrary to you in fury, I will scatter you among the nations. And then also in Deuteronomy 28, and the Lord will scatter you among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other. Okay, another image is the luxuriant vine. Israel is a luxuriant vine that yields its fruit. The more his fruit increased, the more altars he built. As his country improved, he improved his pillars. The pillars the related to the female gods, goddesses. What's expressed, I think, is when times were good, when they were wealthy, in a sense, did they go back to God? Did they become closer to God? No, they actually worshiped the Baals more. And so I think the picture here is when times were good agriculturally, all that did was result in spiritual corruption, took them further away from God rather than closer to God. The more his fruit increased, his country improved, the more he built and the more he repaired for basically Baal worship. And by so doing, they were acknowledging on the face of things that it was Baal who blessed them. Their heart is false. Now they must bear their guilt. The Lord will break down their altars and destroy their pillars. And indeed, I think we will learn enough about the exile to know that, yes, those things happened. For now they will say, we have no king, for we do not fear the Lord. It may be, I'm not sure, but it may be that they're saying the Lord is not our king. And maybe with that, and we don't have good kings, we don't have powerful kings. If we had a real king, what could he do for us? Different ways to understand this. Some say that Hosea is referring to what the people are saying at the time. The Lord is not their king. We don't fear him. We don't obey him. And so not having a strong king, they're left with nothing. And indeed, I think we've mentioned this before, the last five kings, we haven't named them all, but in the history of the Northern Kingdom, the last five kings were usurpers, one killing another and taking over, none of them lasting very long. 10:4, they utter mere words with empty oaths. They make covenants, so judgment springs up like poisonous weeds in the furrows of the field. Here again, maybe a difference of opinion about precisely what's being said. Some say it's the condemnation of the rulers speaking empty words. Others say it's a reference to the people and their false claims, claiming to be faithful to God while they're actually faithful to Baal. So judgment springs up. Actually, judgment can be translated differently as justice, for instance. And I'm not sure of this meaning, but it may be possible. It may suggest that for the corrupted people who have their devotions upside down, justice would appear to be to them would be poisonous weeds in a field that you're cultivating. Not sure about that, but that's one possibility. The inhabitants of Samaria tremble for the calf of Beth-Aven. Samaria is the capital, so sometimes, like here, Samaria again represents Israel or Ephraim. Beth-Aven, remember Beth, house, Aven, wickedness. Hosea, at least after the first time, refuses to say Bethel, house of God. He won't say that, house of wickedness. He just simply says the calf of Beth-Aven, which is Bethel, literally. Its people mourn for it, and so do its idolatrous priests, those who rejoiced over it and over its glory, for it has departed from them. Verse 6, the thing itself, and I think this refers specifically to the calf, and it may have been both calves, Dan and Bethel, will be carried to Assyria. This will be one of the prizes for the king of Assyria, to have that gold. And Ephraim shall be put to shame, and Israel shall be ashamed of his idol. Samaria's king shall perish like a twig on the face of the waters, tossed about this way and that, and then suddenly it's gone. The high places of Aven, so the evil, the wicked high places, the sin of Israel shall be destroyed. Thorn and thistle shall grow up on their altars, and they shall say to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us. More than once, and I think this will be true going forward, there is a brief picture of what the land will be like after the exile. It's not tilled, obviously, because thorns and thistles are growing up rather than crops, and it comes in here. But there's something else then that we'll see in the New Testament. It will be so bad for them that they would rather have the hills fall on them and die that way than go through what they will actually experience. And you know that we have that in the New Testament at the time of, or about the time of the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. I think the indication is Christians were warned to flee Jerusalem at that time, but those who were not Christians would not know that warning. But it was terrible enough that they would have preferred to have the hills and the mountains fall on them. And then in the book of Revelation, as you would remember, the opening of the sixth seal produced the same response. Fall on us. From the days of Gibeah, so Gibeah is mentioned again, you've sinned, O Israel. There they have continued. Shall not the war against the unjust, could be translated the children of injustice, take them in Gibeah? It's back in 9:9 where we started, of course, where Gibeah is mentioned. And I take this simply to mean that if the Benjamites were punished, and they were almost extinguished, and the whole country hurt badly by that civil war, if they were punished back then, would not the continuing sins of Israel expect us to see another punishment, a great punishment like that of Gibeah? The Lord says, when I please, I will discipline them, and nations shall be gathered against them when they are bound up for their double iniquity. It doesn't say so here, but we know enough about the captivity to know that Assyria, maybe some extent Egypt, maybe also even Syria play a hand in the captivity. It's God that's behind it, of course, and they are simply God's tools in the punishment. Double iniquity, maybe a double portion of judgment because of their multiplied iniquity. Okay, another image, a trained calf. Ephraim was a trained calf that loved to thresh, and I spared her fair neck, but I will put Ephraim to the yoke. Judah must plow, Jacob must harrow for himself. Okay, I think this means that Ephraim understood as a young cow, liked to work on the threshing floor. An ox was used to thresh the grain on the threshing floors, but that would be better than pulling plow in the field. Working on the threshing floor, by law, Deuteronomy 25:4, the ox could eat when it chose and had the authority to eat. But it'd be a very different thing to be put in the field to pull the heavy load of the plow or the harrow. And I think probably in this context, pulling the plow or the harrow would picture the slave work in captivity. Notice how Judah is pulled in kind of from the side as an afterthought. That's been a pattern everywhere when we've gotten this far in Hosea. Basically a way of, and don't you forget, Judah, I haven't forgotten you. Your time is coming as well later, but still coming. Jacob, the father of the 12 tribes included here. So I take this to mean, okay, the southern kingdom, Judah, remember what I'm saying to the northern kingdom, Israel, and Jacob, that's all of you, both north and south. This will be the fate, first the northern kingdom and then of the southern kingdom. Sow for yourselves righteousness, reap steadfast love, break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord that he may come and rain righteousness upon you. The threat of judgment, Hosea seems to follow with a call to repentance. First, sow righteousness. You have to sow before you can reap. Two, reap steadfast love. And by the way, that's that big, powerful word for love that we were looking at in the first three chapters in particular of Hosea. So that is back here. Break up your fallow ground. Okay, I come from the country, and I'm getting old now, but I can still remember the time when I might have heard a farmer say, we're going to plow our fallow ground this year. I would bet most of us didn't hear the word fallow last week or last month or maybe last year, but it's a word that would still be understood back in the country, and agricultural people, of course, would know exactly what that is. Seek the Lord that he may come and rain righteousness on you. I didn't add a note to righteousness there. My Hebrew is, my Greek is not great anymore, but my Hebrew is less great. I think, though, this is related to the word that you have heard, shalom, the Jewish greeting, meaning for that would be peace, except the Jew would tell you that it's far more than peace. It's a big word. It wouldn't necessarily mean wealth, but it would mean the good things of life all bundled together. That's my homemade definition. But it is a big word, and righteousness here, I did find out enough to know that it's related to something we would know a little bit about. You have plowed iniquity. You have reaped injustice. You've eaten the fruit of lies because you've trusted in your own way and in the multitude of your warriors. In a sense, they are in a time when they have trusted in power. So that's why they would run to Egypt, try to make an agreement with Egypt to save them against Assyria, or maybe go to Syria for help there, maybe go both places, not telling either that they're going everywhere. But that's what it would mean, that they have trusted in your own way and in the size of your armies, for instance. Therefore, the tumult of the war shall arise among your people, and all your fortresses shall be destroyed, as Shalman destroyed Beth Arbel on the day of battle. Mothers will be dashed in peace, were dashed in pieces with their children. Shalman, I don't think you find anywhere else, so it's possible that means Shalmaneser, the Assyrian king who actually began the activity. He died before what we count as the beginning, the real beginning of the captivity. But that's one possibility. We don't know where Beth Arbel is, but the violence that's pictured goes along with the violence that Assyria always practiced. One of their practices would be to behead people they conquered and take the heads back home to Assyria and that sort of thing. Okay, thank you for listening, and we'll pick up at this point next time.